Welcome to Car Stuff, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm one of your hosts, Scott Benjamin.
And I'm another one of your hosts, Kurt Guerin.
I'm Ben Bolin, also here for some reason. How are you guys doing?
Doing good.
Doing well, thank you. Everything's going great. Hey, you know what? We've had many, many discussions on the show in the past about museums that, you know, one or both of us have traveled to, or just museums in general and collections and all that, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, we've got our favorites, and we've talked about some good, some bad.
Still steamed they didn't make it to that microcar museum before they closed.
Yeah, that's a missed opportunity.
Did you hear about that one, Kurt? It was here in Georgia.
Yeah, it was in, what town was that?
Madison?
Yeah, you're right, Madison. Yeah. Madison, Georgia. It was Bruce Wiener's microcar museum, and the collection was unbelievable. It was just remarkable. You can still catch it online. I mean, the whole collection is preserved in online form. You can look at every car, every spec, you know, a little detail about each vehicle and everything. But to see it in person was pretty impressive. I was there on the last weekend they were open, maybe even the last day before they held the auction.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty impressive. It was a cool thing. But we've seen so many museums, automotive museums, motorcycle museums, whatever, the racing museums. But when you mentioned one that you traveled to very recently, I was more than impressed. And one, by the location, of course. I mean, it's something that we need to investigate a little bit further. I got questions about just where you were and why and all that.
Okay.
But also the museum itself. I've been kind of poking around with some photos of this museum that we're going to talk about, and it looks beautiful. The collection looks amazing. The building looks amazing. You know, the facilities look really, really interesting. I've got a ton of questions. I know Kurt's got some questions as well that he wants to hit you up with. So first question is, maybe a statement.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about a museum that is in Japan. It's the Toyota Automobile Museum, right?
Yeah, that's right, Scott. Earlier this year, I went to Japan for the first time. My girlfriend, Brandy, and I went there. And a lot of people, when they go to Japan, they fly into the Tokyo airport. Tokyo is, of course, the most populous city in Japan. I think it's unfair to even call it a city. It's like 23 different cities or wards all smashed together.
Mm-hmm.
And that airport's very crowded. So we were able to fly, instead of to Tokyo, we flew to a town called Nagoya, which might not be as familiar to a lot of people. It's a smaller area. It's more industrial. It is also famously a Toyota town. And we had planned to land in Japan at the Nagoya airport and spend a few days in Nagoya and then sort of ease our way into Tokyo via the Shinkansen, which I finally rode.
Very cool.
Yeah, which we've talked about for years, man. And while we were in Nagoya, which has a ton of history, I learned of the going toward there, I learned of the automotive museum. And you know how it is. When you travel with your significant other, it's a negotiation. I'm very much of the mind that most relationships are kind of like the Cold War. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And so we had our list of things that, you know, were like Ben's definite must-dos. You know, we would trade off and we would figure out we just prioritized the stuff that we individually wanted to do and what we wanted to let go. And my priority, my number one priority was to check out this museum. And I didn't know what I was getting into. I didn't really want to spoil it because it was a little bit of a gamble. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It was a little bit out of the way for us. And I definitely did not want to have to spend the rest of the trip thinking that I was the one who took us to a stinker museum and knew about it, you know?
I could see that happening where it eats up most of your day.
Right.
And then you get blamed like, well, how often are we going to be in Japan?
Oh, God, or worse, you get the list of things we could have been doing. You know, we've all been in that situation.
Yeah.
So I wanted to avoid that. But when I got there, I was amazed. It's like $9 a person, first off. And it has hundreds of cars, like over 160, and they're not all Toyotas. That's the most astonishing thing. They are from all these different eras. There's a replica of a steam-driven car, and they're really they're really more so interested in, instead of studying the rise of Toyota, don't get me wrong, guys, it's a very Toyota-heavy museum.
Sure.
They are studying the rise of the automobile in general and the rise of the automobile in Japan. The exhibits, and you guys have had a chance to look at these, are much, much older. I mean, this is a building with history. This is a building with some truly priceless automobiles in there.
All right. You know, I got a little bit confused when I was looking this up, so I hope I'm looking at the right one here, Ben, because I know there's a commemorative museum.
Yeah.
That's also in the same area. Toyota, it's got the Toyota label on it. However, that one is more skewed to focus on the Industrial Revolution and the idea of the power loom. And I think there's some, you know, old machinery in that building. It's the old factory where they would produce textiles, that
right.
type of thing. And they've got a small car collection in that building, but it's nothing like the collection that you saw.
Right, yeah, the Toyota Auto Museum. And again, I still can't believe it's like $9 a pop. They're not paying me to say that. That's just, that's crazy.
Yeah, super steep. That's very expensive.
I'm surprised. It's dedicated entirely to the automobile, you know? Maybe it's not so much the automobile, and it's definitely heavy on that. I do remember there was a rickshaw in one of the exhibits.
To me, it almost seems, without having been there, but seeing the list of cars that's there, because you can look at the exhibits online. You can go to their website and find that.
Yeah.
It looks like maybe I read this somewhere, but it seems like they're focused on like the style of the cars mm-hmm. and the advancements that have been made along the way mm-hmm. and like kind of like these milestones, you know, to say like, hey, look what we were doing in the early 1900s and here's what we did between 1920 and 1930. And not just we Toyota, but we, because Toyota wasn't around until, 1937, I believe. That was the very first, the founding of Toyota.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, in eras before that and after that, they're focusing on, the automotive, as you said, automotive industry as a whole mm-hmm. and the advancements that have been made to how we got from where we started to where we are now. And I find that pretty fascinating mm-hmm. to build a collection in that way.
Yeah.
You know, these significant makes and models for some reason, you know, style
yeah.
or technology.
Also, a shout out to our old Toyota episode where we explore the origin story of the company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The way that the cars are displayed when they're positioned next to Toyotas or even in the same building as Toyotas, it kind of tells you the story of why Toyota designed certain cars a certain way. When you see cars from America, like say from the late 50s, like a big Cadillac,
right,
and then
right.
you see a European like compact car, and then you see the Toyota of the same time period, all the other cars are there to kind of tell Toyota's story in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's definitely an emphasis on that, but there's also an emphasis on the evolution of automotive manufacturing. As we had talked about in some previous episodes, starting your own homegrown car company is one of the most difficult things a country can do, and that's the reason why a relatively small number of large auto manufacturers dominate the global industry. So what Japan does is historic and impressive. Now, if you think back at what shape the country was in terms of infrastructure at the close of World War II, to have come from that to a place where Japanese vehicles, including Toyota, are often regarded as some of the most consistent on the planet nowadays,
mm-hmm.
that is nothing short of amazing. One thing that stood out to me that I thought you guys would appreciate, because I remember I was texting you some of these pictures, is that they also have a lot of weird cars, weird one-offs. You know, it's kind of like when you go into a museum for another big idea, like the Coke Museum here in Atlanta, and you see all this stuff that didn't work.
Yeah,
you know,
I like that.
So one example, there's this micro car, going back to our earlier thing. It's a three-wheel car, the Fuji Cabin Model 5A. It looks like it's from a Pixar film. It has the face of the vehicle. It has one Cyclops-like headlight, and it has, the air intake at the front. Looks like a dumb open mouth.
It almost looks like the size of a wheelbarrow, with the wheels of a wheelbarrow, really.
I mean,
it's that small. It's a
one
microcar.
Wheel in the back.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You're right.
It's the
yeah.
tadpole design.
You're right. It's that tadpole design, and it's an interesting vehicle. I mean, but cars like that, I love to see cars like that among all the other stuff. You know, that it's kind of an ordinary car. It's not necessarily anything flashy or anything. It's unusual now, of course.
Yeah.
But at the time, you know, it was just a commuter car. It was a car just to get around as a daily ride for somebody, clearly, and it's very simple, very. I don't know. In a way. It's classy that it's simple, but it's also very, very plain, you know, very plain looking. I mean, it's not something that would draw your attention other than it's kind of a standout among others in this museum, because I know there are some fantastic cars in the museum, too. And not just, like you said, cars from Japan, but there's, you know, there's a Tucker there.
Yes.
You mentioned there's a steam car there. I'm not sure. Is it a Stanley car? I don't remember exactly who made that one. There's Cadillacs, Peugeots. There's all kinds
Mercedes,
of cars.
Mercedes.
Yeah.
Rolls Royce.
Yeah. Lincolns. There's, you know, Stutz Bearcats that you can see there. There's some incredible vehicles. I'm looking right now at the website, which is toyota.co.jp. Yeah. And you can find an English-Japanese version. If you search, if you do, you know, a quick Google search, we'll turn up the same thing. And then when you get to the website, if you go to, I believe it's the Exhibits tab.
Mm-hmm.
If you go under Exhibits, you can look at the list of vehicles on display, not necessarily the automobile gallery, because that'll show you more of, you know, just kind of aesthetics of the building itself and, you know,
right,
displays.
Right.
But go to the Exhibits, the automobiles on display, and you can get a real sense for what's there and the diversity of what's there, because that's always the impressive part to me. And even more so, it's maybe I get the feeling, Ben, and I have to ask you this because, again, I've never been to Japan. I've never been to this museum, obviously.
Okay.
Have a lot of questions about the museum itself because I've been to good. I've been to some bad ones. Some stand out to me because of the way that they're displayed, the way that the building is laid out, the way that they're the way that the cars are lit. You know, the distance between the cars, how close you can get to the cars. You know, there's a lot to making a good museum versus just, you know, throwing a bunch of cars in the same room together, you know, door to door, nose to nose. You know, and I've seen places like that. And it's not that they're horrible and they've got great cars. It's just that you don't necessarily get all the views, all the impressions of that car that you necessarily want or you are trying to get. You don't feel like you've got the fulfilling experience. And it looks to me like this one, you get a pretty good view of each car. It looks like the building itself is well done. You know, it's classy.
Sure.
It looks like it's a calm place to visit. I don't anticipate there's any music playing or anything like that.
It is thrash metal the entire time. And it's Japanese, so you don't know what they're screaming.
It just looks like a peaceful place to stroll around, look at the cars, you know, kind of get lost in yourself a little bit, lost in your memories or, you know, whatever, you know, just the maybe the vision of yourself behind the wheel or, you
sure.
know, whatever. I mean, it looks like a pleasant place to visit. Is that the general feeling of the place?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There, when we went, it was not especially crowded. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, we were also there toward the a weekday afternoon, I believe. Mm-hmm. So
that's always nice.
Yeah. And there weren't any field trips. There were a couple people there with their kids. There were a couple of older people. There was probably one non-Japanese group other than us.
Mm-hmm.
What stood out to me the most was, first off, I was not expecting a Tucker all the way out in Nagoya, Japan, which shows how much I know.
Oh, right? Yeah.
And that Tucker, by the way, is drivable. They didn't let me drive it. But
yeah, of course not.
It works, is what I'm saying.
Interesting.
They had very little in the way of barriers, right? And for some of the vehicles, especially the more stately, you know, pre-1930s, like proper carriage type things, they would have steps up and you would stand on, I don't know, like the fancy version of a stepladder, essentially, so that shorter people could see inside. Occasionally, you would see something like the gullwing doors would be open, or you could... One thing I did, which may have been pushing the line a little bit, was to describe the way the cars are laid out. There's space between them, so you can generally see, in every vehicle, you can see at least 3/4 of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, there may be some part of it where the back corner is tucked against something.
Sure, yeah.
So you can't really get behind it. But the only boundary between you and these vehicles is going to be a small, like, plastic string, probably about maybe a foot off the floor.
Hmm.
So
I wouldn't have expected that.
It's not Fort Knox, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I'm not proposing that we conduct a heist. I'm just saying it would be, you know, it wouldn't be hard.
Be a lot easier than some of the other places. But you know, yeah. You're mentioning something that I found like really intriguing about other places that I've been. I've been to the Lane Museum outside of Nashville.
Yeah, yeah.
And you could walk completely around the cars. There were no barriers. And I think there might have been around a couple of cars that were there. Boy, I'm stretching my memory now to remember. It was years ago, but I feel like you could get right up to them and peer in as long as you didn't touch them. As long as you didn't touch the car, you're okay. But you could get right up next to the car. And I found that fascinating because I had never seen that before in another museum. Usually you're kept back with, you know, the big thick velvet ropes and they're, you know, waist high.
Right.
And a significant distance away, you know, where, you know, you're not allowed to get anywhere near. You can't lean in and smell what that car smells like.
Right.
Which is a part of the experience. You know, you can lean in and smell the old leather and maybe the wood that's got oil soaked into it, that kind of thing. I love that.
There were some cars where you could get the whole walk around. Like if like the Rolls Royce, the Silver Ghost,
mm-hmm.
which was red and gold.
Holy cow.
Yeah, it was red and gold, though.
Wow.
And it was, you could walk around that vehicle. I quickly figured out that you can do what I call the lean. Everybody's had to be in a museum where you want to touch the stuff. You know about the lean. We all know about the lean.
Yeah.
It's like dart. It's like the same rules as playing darts. As long as your foot is behind the line, you're okay. But I did learn when person working at the museum was a little bit concerned because I got down on the ground. I was trying to look at the undercarriage of a couple of things, and they were very polite. And they came up and they said, "Hi, can I help you?" And I, of course, was very embarrassed.
Thought you were having a medical emergency down there on the floor.
I think they knew exactly what I was doing.
You know, I wonder if you, I was just thinking about this, you know, I know the lean that you're talking about, right? Trying to get a better look.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I wonder if this would be a good strategy. And now I'm an idea guy. You know that, right?
Yeah, you're a big picture dude.
I'm not much about implementing, you know, these ideas, but let's say this, like Kurt, you're tall, right? You're pretty tall.
Yeah.
So you'd be able to lean a significant distance over a vehicle, but there's a point where you lose your balance, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, it's not very far over. What if you were to wear like weighted pants, you know, like something like lead pants,
uh-huh.
you know, and that's practical. I mean, I know that's extremely practical for everybody to wear lead pants around, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But what? How about ankle weights or a welt, like a weight belt maybe that would keep your weight, you know, like more the center of gravity would be much lower and behind you.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if that would work if you could lean like a lot farther.
Yeah, if I were there with you guys, I could have ropes tied to my shirt. And each of y'all could grab one and just let me go in.
You know,
I could basically get on, you know, I could get inside the window with my head.
That's equally feasible, I think, you know, to my lead pants idea.
Yeah, I mean,
what about almost like a
judgment and brainstorming?
How about a chest mounted kickstand that you could, you know, deploy under the ground so you could get the full lean
and
your whole body back? You'd look like, you know, a ski jumper in the air. You know how they lean forward on their skis like that?
For the big ski jumps.
Yeah, exactly. It would look like that, only leaning over into the window of a museum piece.
So the biggest question about that, again, no judgment in brainstorming. Mm-hmm. It's not saying no to any of these. The biggest question I have is when to deploy these brilliant techniques and devices. I think there are like, if I recall correctly, there are 13 zones.
13 zones?
That I for sure remember. Yeah,
whoa.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it goes from the dawn of the automobile to the advancement to the acceptance. And then probably, you guys, I mean, probably a couple of my favorite zones there were pretty early on. The salon vehicles, that was zone 4. And that's, you know, kind of the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
1920s, just like egregiously luxurious stuff.
I'm looking at them right now. There's an Essex coach. There's a Morgan Arrow.
Yeah.
Gosh, what else? Bugatti Type 35B, which is pretty nice. That's a great
Duesenberg.
Car.
They have a Duesenberg.
Model A, of course. Duesenberg Model J, that looks nice. I mean, there's some incredible cars. You can click on any one of these links on their webpage and see a photograph and a paragraph describing each one in Japanese and in English.
And then they have a lot of deep cuts that I think would surprise anybody who enjoys older vehicles. Like, they have a Stutz.
Yeah. I mentioned that earlier because that's one that stands out to me, the Stutz Bearcat. I always find that as a funny car because I think Mr. Burns on The Simpsons owned a Stutz Bearcat. And I remember being in an episode early on, you know, like the lazy chief police Wiggum, right?
Uh-huh.
He's kind of kicked back in his car eating probably a donut, if I had to guess.
Sure.
And Burns is making his escape, and he's in a Stutz Bearcat, right? And they report it as a red Stutz Bearcat, I think, or so, I'm going to mix this up, but like a red Stutz Bearcat in 1914 or whatever. And the police chief sees it goes by and he says, that's more of a burgundy, and just lets it go.
I remember that.
Hilarious to me. I mean, it's funny because, you know, just it's such an unusual vehicle. And of course, Mr. Burns, a character like that would own a vehicle like that. But, you know, these cars, these kind of one-offs, the specials that you see when you walk around the corner, you know, and don't expect that. That to me is what really kind of turns me on about certain museums versus other museums where you kind of know what's going to be there. You're a little bit surprised, but sometimes, man, they really catch you off guard, don't they?
Yeah, I think that's what happened when I dragged my girlfriend along, too, because she actually enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Which surprised me a little because I think she thought maybe it was just going to be all Toyotas, probably more of an emphasis on the 80s or something, you know?
Yeah, like, great, a museum dedicated to the Prius.
Finally. What a time to be alive.
And I'm sure that, you know what, there probably was a Prius there, right? I mean, I'm sure they've got their current product line there, you know, a lot of them anyway.
I'm going to be honest with you guys. This may be a function of attention span, or it may be a function of just like worrying about time spent wisely. But when I go to museums like this, especially any museum that focuses on the history of something that's fascinating, I end up taking forever in the beginning and then get kind of inundated with information. So by the time I had made it to, let's say the 80s, by the time I made it to the 1980s, I started thinking, I've seen a Toyota Corolla.
So you're just doing a walk. You're doing a walk, just a walk through at that point, right?
I'm walking around. Yeah. And I'm stopping for vehicles because there were some vehicles that I had not seen up close, like the Yunos Roadster.
Mm-hmm.
I had not seen one of those up close. And that was weird to me because it's a Mazda Miata.
Yeah.
It's a Mazda Miata.
Sure.
But being called a Yunos Roadster made it new and fascinating. And
somehow intriguing.
Yeah, because in the early auto history of Japan, their first vehicles they were making were licensed rather than completely domestically created. And Toyota led the charge on creating vehicles in Japan for the Japanese market from Japanese parts. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So for them to take that step is impressive, but it also means, you know, this is something that we have talked about in the past. It also means there are a lot of things just sold under different names, you know?
Yeah.
Which has always fascinated me and still fascinates me today. You know what? I'm going to be honest. It still confuses me today, because there are, I'm sure everybody listening, we have a couple of different examples of stuff that we just thought of. You know, it's sold in Europe as one name, or in Australia as one name, and then sold in the U.S. for some reason as another name. I don't know the logic behind that.
Or even very similar cars that are sold here under different brands, like, you know, the Subaru car, the BRZ, and the, what was the other one? The Scion. Oh, I'm gonna forget it now. dang it. Oh, the Toyota, it's a Toyota, I believe, right? Yeah, I was just thinking of an example that is a pretty easy one for everyone to pick out on the roads today. Even, you know, Subaru sells that BRZ car, and then there's a Scion, or at least it was a Scion, now it's Toyota, I think. But it's the exact same vehicle, you know, and I think it's the 86, Kurt. Is that what you said? It was it's now called the 86. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's different car companies, essentially the same vehicle, different badging, a few different, you know, options, you know, engines, things like that are available. But it's just an interesting thing that, you know, that they do, that they share these platforms. And it's always kind of strange. Hey, you know what? One thing, Kurt, I'm gonna put you on the spot here just for a second, if you don't mind.
Ooh, here we go.
So you haven't really heard of any like car museums that you've gone to that you really like or dislike, or are you a big car museum frequenter? Do you go there and check things out, or not necessarily when
not
you go to a new town?
Not necessarily.
Yeah, you've been banned from a lot, right?
Yeah, that's true. That's true for various reasons. I went to the Corvette Museum a long time ago.
Oh yeah. Up in Bowling Green,
Kentucky. Yeah,
mm-hmm. I think I said frequenter. That's a terrible. That's making up my own words. Are you there often? Is what I meant. And I guess not. But what? So you were there at the Corvette Museum pre-sinkhole, I would guess.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
It was
okay.
This back in the 90s. Maybe,
yeah,
right after it was built.
You narrowly missed being just swallowed up by the earth. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
I didn't know that danger was brewing beneath.
Yeah.
Us.
Who did? Yeah. Who would know? Right. But that's one place that I have never stopped. I've even stayed in the hotel across the street from it because it's like
Didn't make it.
No. Because it just didn't fit into the stupid schedule that we had. You know what I mean? It's a good stopover point on my way up to Michigan.
Oh,
there you go.
Okay.
So
that's
if I'm going to stop in Indiana first to visit family in Wabash, Indiana, and then on to Michigan or you know whatever. It's a good point for me to drive to after work here one day on like a Friday.
Mm-hmm.
End up there and then early the next morning leave. So, you know, I'm not there during museum hours. Can't even make a token appearance there, you know, for an hour. It's just I'm, you know, tired from the day and the road, and you have to get up the next morning at 6 a.m. to get on the road or something to go.
Man,
so
yeah.
It's frustrating, but I'll get there. And they have a motorsports park across the road that I also like to go to and check out. And, of course, the factory, which they offer tours for. And, man, they're going to start building that rear engine vet there soon.
Yeah.
And I'm really jacked about that. I really am. I want to do a full episode soon about that vet.
Yeah.
I'm excited about it. That's a cool thing that we've talked around the edge of in the past because it was never really a thing that was going to happen. I mean, it was going to, but we never knew when.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now that it's here, man, we should definitely delve into it.
Yeah, we've been waiting for that one for a while, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You know what? I didn't mean to derail us that much.
No, it's perfect.
I do that all the time. But but let's get back to this museum. I mean, do you think you spent like the whole day there? Do you think you spent like, 8 hours there, 5 hours there, two hours? What was
probably,
it?
Probably about 4 hours, but wanted to spend a longer amount of time there.
Yeah.
You know, it's weird because we're in a country that's new to me. My girlfriend had been there before, but neither of us have been to this town before.
Mm-hmm.
So we wanted to be, you know, conscious of how long it took to get from point A to point B, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because, without going into the full details, one time we were in a different country and we took a ski lift. Up. It was supposed to be a romantic thing. We took a ski lift to the top of this mountain, and then we found out that you still had to wait in line for the round trip, and the line was like 2 hours long. And so I said, you know, I had the bright idea. It's like, hey, all right, you know, it can't be that bad. It's all downhill. And so it was that bad.
Oh.
And it took about it took a long time to walk down there, and then we were at the Seoul, South Korea's version of the interstate outside of the city, and then I had to so we're very cautious.
That sounds very romantic.
Yeah. Oh, thanks, man.
Way to go, Ben.
Yeah, real winner there. But to answer your question, long story short, it was four hours and change, but it could have been more because there are two buildings. There's the main building. There's kind of this annex thing, and they don't just have odd or historically significant cars. They also have like real beast. Like they had a Dino 246 GTS. They have this room that's just like high-end kick-ass sports cars.
Exotics and things like
that.
You know, one of my favorite cars that's there, it's kind of I would say it's not nondescript by any means. I mean, I don't know if I'm using the right term for this, but it's a little more simple, I guess, in design. It's not like a design like an exotic, but it has that feel to me because it looks an awful lot like a Jaguar E-Type. It is a, here it is right here, the 2000 GT made by Toyota.
It's the model MF10.
It's a 1968 model, and I believe that a 1967 model was the one that they used in a James Bond film. I don't remember which film it was now, but I saw that car the first time I'd ever seen that car in person at the Peterson Museum. It was also a white version of this, but it was made into a convertible, which I thought was kind of cool. So a roadster version of the same car. But it's beautiful, and of course, there's very, very few of these made. I don't remember how many were made, but it's like, you know, in the low, maybe 200s, I think, at the most. It's just a beautiful looking car to me, and it has that classic look, and it has something, a feature that Kurt had pointed out that a lot of these cars have, that you were a little bit confused about at first, I think.
The mirrors on the hood.
Yeah.
Or on the side of the, the fender.
Yeah, the front fender mirrors, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's a cool look. Do you like the look?
Yeah, it's neat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see you're still a little bit on the fence about it.
It looks different when you're behind the wheel.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, it's just it's an interesting place to put them, I know, but it makes a lot of sense when you're talking about a car that is like a sports car, you know. This is definitely a sports car, this Toyota 2000 GT model. But the fenders are mounted way far in front of the front glass.
Yeah.
Not in the usual position on the driver door, passenger door.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is so that, you know, to get that rear view, all you have to do is kind of avert your eyes a little bit instead of turning your head left or right in order to see that. So, you know, the driver can keep their focus forward and just kind of, you know, like dart their eyes left or right and be able to catch what's going on behind them. And now you get a restricted view, but typically these mirrors will have a convex surface so that you get more of a fisheye view. It's kind of in between, you know.
I wonder why that died out, because you can look through cars from the 80s and 70s and you can see other examples of that, like the at least at this museum, for sure, the Toyota Soarer had those side lamps that were hood mounted.
Yeah.
We also saw the Colt Gallant from 71 had that. Even the Honda Civic and the ones on the Honda Civic were way up there, man. Yeah. They were like right behind the headlights.
Well, they had to be. That was a small car, very small car, right?
Oh, I guess you're right.
Yeah, but I like this. I really like the design. I think the sad answer to this is that it had to be part of pedestrian safety. You know how they took the hood ornaments off of cars, and the front ends are kind of smoothed out, and bumper heights are standard now. They're not like super low like they used to be, or not super high like they used to be. Although I'm seeing a trend in trucks where it's becoming like a wall coming down the road. You know, normal consumer pickup trucks,
but I think like the side mirror is like the size of a forearm.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but I mean, you see that, you know, the position of these where if they were to hit a pedestrian and they were to roll over the hood of that vehicle, that would probably kill somebody or significant damage, if nothing else. So I think it's pedestrian safety.
I could see that, but I would present an alternative hypothesis.
Oh, what's that?
What if it is somehow easier to park or drive in dense areas?
Yeah.
You can't reach them to adjust.
Oh, that's why they changed it. I'm sure.
Okay.
Yeah. But I'm saying like maybe.
Before like automated, you know,
yeah, good
rear
point.
Mirrors.
Yeah. How many times have I brought this car? I had an MG that had these mirrors.
A
long time ago. I had an MG Arkley. It was a kit car, you know, made out of an MG midget. And I'll have to show you photos, Kurt.
Ben
knows it.
Yeah.
But it had mirrors like this. And I do recall that adjusting those things was difficult. And sometimes they would, you know, shake loose and, you know, like adjust themselves. And it's frustrating because you have to pull over to adjust them back into position. But they were fantastic. I love the position of them. I love being able to, again, just kind of quickly dart your eyes over and see what's behind you is really nice. And I thought that it's still overall, I think it's a cool look. I really like the look of those fender mirrors like that. I think it really is.
It just seems like they would be
effective.
Too far away to see anything.
No, it's really not. It's not uncomfortable. No, of course, my car was very, very small. So, you know, the distance is more like the Honda Civic that we're talking about than this car, which is a little bit farther away.
But now you can, to your point, Kurt, now that it's very common for people to be able to electronically adjust those side mirrors.
Sure.
There's, I wonder why they haven't come back. Maybe you're right. Maybe it's pedestrian safety.
It's got to be. It's got to be something
like that. I think nowadays, that's what it has to be.
Oh, they get ripped off in every, automated car wash that people take their cars through or something.
Oh, gosh,
maybe that's another issue.
Do you guys remember having to unscrew your antenna before you took it?
I do.
Yes. Car wash.
Yeah. Kurt's way too young.
Are you too young for that?
No.
You gotta screw off it.
No, he's not. I'm just joking with him.
I've had to, reach out of the window. And
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess they still do a version of that where they put that little sleeve over the rear window wiper and they tape it down sometimes. Yeah,
it's
always frustrating if they tape that down. You have to get out and peel that stuff off.
So there's something else here, and I think it's a bigger trend that we see when we look at museums like this and the many fantastic auto museums throughout the U.S. and the world at large. It's that we can conduct our own kind of forensic analysis of these trends that came and went. I don't know why, but walking around where we saw the old school 20s to 30s era cars like the Packard 12, the Packard 12, the so-called Roosevelt car.
Sure.
Right?
Packard's one of your favorites anyway.
It's true. It's true. But one of the things that hit me about it is I was walking around and I was thinking, man, these cars were so expensive at the time that the assumption was if you could afford one, you could afford to pay somebody else to drive you around in it. And that's why the cabins were divided. And it was like because nobody was buying one of these, or very few people were buying one of these and saying like, whew. I mean, my daily driver helped me get to work more quickly. They're like buying it for parades and state processions.
So your daily driver was actually a person and had a name.
Yes. Your daily driver was Neil.
They just happened to be in a Cadillac or in a Packard 12. Yeah, that's right.
And,
just make one quick point here is that I also was looking into, and I want to get back to the museum and we'll kind of wrap that up in a minute, but the location of this place is perfect, right? I mean, of course, it's near the port where they ship most of their product from.
Yeah.
We find that the port of Nagoya it's an old port. In fact, it predates Toyota. It goes back to 1907 when they opened this port, and it's enormous. It's a huge place. And I tried to do something here that I thought was clever at first, and then I saw a couple of my errors along the way, and I it kind of fell apart at some point. But I'll tell you what I did. I tried to look at the area in the city of Nagoya and the port of Nagoya with the water combined. And I don't know why I looked at it with water combined, but I did. And the square meters, the square miles and all that, right? So the water area of the port is something like, and I'll do this both ways, I guess, but just over 82 million square meters, which is about 31.8 square miles of just water in the port. So that's a big port, right?
Yeah, yeah.
This place has 21 piers and 290 berths. That means they can have as many as nearly 300 ships in the yard at one time. And it's not just Toyota. There's a lot of things that come in and out of Nagoya,
sure,
of course. They do something like 2.1 million containers every year go in and out of that place. That's how many are shipped in and out of that port every single year. And those are containers that are the size of the backs of semis. You know, when you see the containers on the back of semis, that's what we're talking about. So when we see them stacked on the back of the ships, they're loaded up with material. That's what's in them is cars. It's it's not only automobiles, but it's other products that they're shipping out as well. 32,400 vessels every year go in and out of there. That's how many arrive in the port every single year. And that was a 2009 number. So that's 10 years old, that number that I found. So that the shipping has probably gone up. Now, The land area that I've neglected to tell you up until this point, which I forgot, is about 16.3 square miles. So if you combine the two, it's right around 48 square miles. And I was trying to think, okay, well, how big is that really, 48 square miles? Because it's a massive area. It's somewhere around the size of if you were to take all of Boston, Massachusetts. That's roughly 48 square miles.
Wow.
If you were to take all of Peoria, Illinois, or Salem, Oregon, or I think Fargo, North Dakota, those areas are all about 48 square miles. They're 48, 49, somewhere around there. So that's the size of the port area that we're talking about. And that's just one little area here, but that's all shipping. And a lot, again, most of Toyota's product comes out of there from, you know, from the Asian production facilities that they put these cars together in. You know, of course, we know they have plants all over the world, but that's where most of their product originates from. So it's a huge, huge place. And as you can imagine, most of the people in the cities in and around Nagoya are employed by either the shipping industry, the pier, I guess, the operations at the pier, somehow related to that port, or automotive suppliers or automotive manufacturers, because there's many big factories that have strategically located themselves right in that area as well. Not just Toyota, but other automotive manufacturers.
Sure, Mitsubishi
as well.
is there.
Yep.
Or they have an R&D place there.
Mm-hmm.
Spark plug makers, component creators, even the rail car rolling stock manufacturers, Shinkansen manufacturers are there.
Sure, yeah.
And
you said that twice now. That's high-speed trains.
Right, yeah, sorry, yeah, bullet trains, we call them. They are insane, you know what I mean? They put our little train network here in Atlanta to shame.
What do you know what your top speed was? Just offhand, you know, roughly?
The one I was on, I believe, was going, I mean, easily in excess of 200 miles an hour, but it doesn't feel like it.
No.
You know?
Not until you look out the window.
No. Yeah. Until you look out the window.
Yeah.
And the thing that's amazing is how on time they are and how quickly they stop. And also, it's much more like being on a plane. You know how before air travel became more affordable, like we saw this at the Hershey Museum in Pennsylvania, the Hershey Automotive Museum. Before air travel became more affordable, most people would travel long distances on charter buses. And the charter buses was very much like going on a plane. You had like flight attendants, bus attendants. They would cook stuff and serve it to you. They had uniforms.
They had footrests. There was overhead storage that was, you know, like wood, like shelving.
Yeah.
And they had, you know, really nice plush seats. These coaches were beautiful. I mean, it was like a pretty, I mean, more than acceptable way to get around. It was pretty luxurious in a way. I mean, I still know that, you know, there were better ways to travel, but this wasn't too bad, really. I mean, lots of leg room, lots of shoulder room. It was definitely a good way to get across the country if you had to. A little slower than plane, obviously. A little bit. But man, they were cool looking. They really were. There was a whole basement full of them, wasn't there?
Yes.
When we went there, and we were able to,
huge basement.
We were able to get on them and kind of sit in the driver's seat and stuff. I think that was stuff that they were letting us do.
Let us do it because we were taking a behind-the-scenes tour.
Yeah.
We also got to see where they were fixing up a lot of those vehicles.
Yep. Our friend Glenn Beck arranged that for us.
Yeah, thank you, Glenn.
And we thank him for that because that was quite an experience all around. It was a lot of fun. Something I'll always remember.
Let me point this out. I was mistaking that Shinkansen speed. I was confusing my kilometers and my miles per hour.
Yeah.
I believe it was 300 kilometers an hour, which makes about 186 miles per hour.
That's still fast. That's, you know what? That's still 200 miles an hour to me. That's quick. I mean, 14 miles an hour doesn't matter when you're going 186, I don't think. You know, that's,
well, one thing that does really hit you about the speed of that kind of transportation, which I'm sure you're familiar with, Scott, is that if you go the wrong way or you miss your stop, you don't have a lot of time to recover from that one.
Yeah, exactly. I would, I definitely... I had, you know, the nerves. I traveled on a maglev train, but I had the knowledge of knowing that there's only one train on the track at the time, you know, and it's pretty easy to sit back and relax on that
and
one versus
where you're supposed to be going.
Yeah, when there's like other trains that you're worried about being switched onto your line, that would be a whole lot more nerve-wracking, I think. And not that that's necessarily happened a lot, but there have been some incidents here and there. It's very few and far between, though. But man, that's really cool that you got to do that. Something that we've been talking about.
Gosh,
And what a trip. I mean, overall, I'm sure you didn't eat anything gross on the streets out there or anything. You didn't eat any gross street food or anything.
I know you because you're
not an adventurous eater at all. You're very meat and potatoes kind of guy.
All right, I'm going to tell you. Do you want to know one of the weirdest things I ate?
Wait. Let me make sure I have a bucket nearby just in case.
You might not be comfortable with it.
Really, Kurt, he has an extremely adventurous diet.
With a very win in Rome attitude. I know this may not be super popular with some of us listening, but I had to try it at least once. I ate horse. A horse sashimi, which means it was raw.
Yeah, wow.
And it's an interesting experience, but I I don't see myself doing that again in the future, unless I have to survive or something.
Yeah, sure.
But, you know.
You ate horse.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Okay. All right. That's fascinating. I'm not going to take this any direction that I shouldn't right now, but that's okay. Great. That's great.
I
good
thought
you
would be happy that
good for you.
I didn't say seafood.
Yeah.
Although
yeah,
I thought you were creatures of the deep, man.
I thought you were going to go with, I ate a tarantula on a stick or something like that. You know, I thought I was going to be just repulsed by this, but I can kind of understand it. If that is I think some people are going to have trouble with that. I could see somebody getting upset, but
I can see that too. But
what do you think? I mean, okay, so yeah. Now I know somebody who's knowingly eaten horse. I've had some steaks at some bad places that I assume are a horse's ass steak.
Oh wow!
You know, it's bad.
Sizzler in front of me.
No, I've actually labeled it like, oh boy, this is the horse's ass cut of steak. I can tell. but seriously, like, what was the texture? What was it like? Was it like red meat or?
Yeah,
what?
Yeah, okay. It was like red meat. It was, it had a surprising kind of sweet note to it. There was this sauce. The weirdest thing is the way they served it to us.
Oh, wait, I've had this before at Arby's. There's horsey sauce.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah,
it's
you right know.
It's in a packet. It's
Now that you mention it, I was at an Arby's. It's a very high-end restaurant.
Oh, this is I understand now.
Full
I understand.
Circle. Yeah. Well, the weird thing was when they served this to us, we were in an okay restaurant. We were in like a nice date restaurant. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It wouldn't be a super, super expensive restaurant.
Oh, sure.
But just a nicer place.
Yeah. Fancy and pants.
Yeah. It's Arby's.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, sure.
So I had a tie on.
Had the roast beef.
anyway, this place, which was technically not an Arby's, but don't let that ruin the story. The weird thing was when we ordered it, at first they didn't believe it. And I thought, well, you know, neither of us are fluent in Japanese. Maybe this is a different translation. Maybe this is some kind of cut of beef or something that I'm not aware of. And I'm checked with the staff there. And they were like, yeah, no, that's a horse. Do you want some horse? Because we'll give it to you. And so I was in a situation where I said, well, we have to. And so we ordered some, not like a huge platter. We weren't like, just bring the whole thing out.
Yeah. You didn't have to go select it from a pin of horses
lobster
or something?
Right,
Like, I'll have that one.
Right. But when we tried it, the strangest thing about it is, like, there was no, like, great ceremony with bringing this out, except when they brought out the sauce, because there was this wide, shallow bowl, and at the very bottom, in like an indented circular area, that was where the sauce lived. I don't know why the bowl was so wide, nor why it was so shallow. It was like a curved plate with a little dollop of this admittedly pretty tasty sauce. And I was thinking when they brought this out, I was like, wow, do people mainly just order this for the sauce? You know, like how you have to order chips when you order queso dip, because otherwise you look like like you have a problem.
Was it really, there's something wrong with you. Was it like really intense flavor, or was it like
it was like kind of smoky, sweet. Wasn't, I would not say it was super duper intense. It wasn't bad. I learned that there are some problems people have with that industry, like the provenance of the horses themselves.
Yeah.
But also, you know, we have to admit, here in the States, we can be a little bit hypocritical about what we consider edible, not edible, objectionable, and fine.
Sure.
And, you know, pigs are quite intelligent, and that's never stopped me from getting a pulled pork barbecue sandwich at Arby's.
Yeah, sure. There's sacred cows, you know, of course.
We've
all heard that. But yeah, I understand, like, it's just a different region of the world. They have different, you know, norms, I guess. And that's why I was saying controversial. I mean, you'd have to look into how it's harvested, I guess.
Right.
And you know, the practices behind that.
I can't believe that.
It's interesting. You've got good travel stories. That's
I'm
good.
Sorry that I derailed us so much here.
No.
But, you know, I'm also just going to point out, okay, I was a vegetarian years back for a few years. So I feel like I put my time in. You know what I mean? I'm still catching up with everybody.
Yeah, I get you. Hey, you didn't derail us, man. That's a trip to Japan deserves at least an episode of talking about what you saw, what you did, and the food, of course, is part of it. You know, just the culture and, you know, everything around that trip. So I'm fascinated to hear about, you know, when anybody travels, Kurt, if you travel anywhere in the future or have traveled anywhere that you want to talk about, let's have at it here on this show, because there's always something fascinating to discover about new places.
And, for sure.
You know, we have our questions, and I'm sure listeners have their questions. Maybe some of them are overlap, and we'll, you know, answer some of them for them out there, you know.
Guys, let's go on an adventure together.
Yeah.
The only way the Nagoya Museum could have been cooler is if you guys were there, too.
Aw, oh, shucks. That's so nice.
It's all right.
Thanks,
I don't mean
it. Maybe not at the Romantic Horse Museum.
Oh,
or not
God.
Horse museum. Horse, I'm sorry, horse restaurant. Yeah.
Oh boy.
Yeah,
I don't know. Yeah. Was it a horse restaurant?
No, no. They just had it on the menu. No.
It was called Roy Rogers Triggers. Is that the?
They had it on the menu, and I felt like we just we had to do it. Was it my proudest moment? No. Do I regret it? Not really.
Oh, that's all right. Yeah. I mean, you got to do it.
But also on the very last note. This is something that I think a lot of people in the audience who've traveled will also notice. Every time I'm in a different country, man, I'm so weirded out by which cars are common and which are considered fancy, or, you know, what's considered obscure. You go to some places and it's just Fiats everywhere.
Yeah.
Like, why wouldn't you have a Fiat?
Sure.
And you go to other places and, like, you know, it's weird. It's weird how Mercedes are not impressive cars in some country.
Yeah.
And I keep wondering, I'm like, are they just super cheap here? Are we the ones getting ripped off?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Like, just to find out what's the norm there versus the norm here. And, you know, the oddballs are the ones that always intrigue me, like you said. Like, when you know, you're in a certain region and you find out that, hey, just about everybody has a three-wheel car here, you know, and it's pretty, it's pretty rare where we are, but, you know, it's something that's commonly seen there. You see it on the you know, side of the road all the time. They're rented to tourists. They're rented, you know, the people that do find them different or unique or exciting in some way, and they know that, you know, right? So they kind of prey on that. But, yeah, good for them. It's fun. It's always interesting to travel. I love doing it. And you get good stories like the Nagoya Toyota Museum. I don't have the name exactly right there. I know that the Toyota Automobile Museum of Nagoya, I think, is what it's called, if you want to search for it and check out what Ben has already seen in the past. And I'm a bit jealous, Ben. I'm a little jelly, as the kids say, of you being able to go there and do that. But I know it also takes a lot of hard work to be able to get to do something like that. So good for you. That's a good experience. Good life experience.
Thanks, man. We were fortunate not to have to walk down a mountain that time.
Yeah,
didn't get kicked out of the country, which I take as a solid win, given my past. So,
or the museum,
which I got close. I wish I had known about the you guys' techniques earlier.
Yeah.
If I had that kickstand, some weighted pants.
Yeah. Well, you know what they say, Ben. Dog sleds don't have rearview mirrors.
That was perfect.
Well, you know, I mean, that's the way it works. That's the way it works. I mean, it all comes around, right? Full circle.
Full circle.
Yeah, exactly. So. Oh, gosh. Have we exhausted the Nagoya Toyota Museum yet?
I think we've done an okay job just sketching out some of the high notes of the museum. Thank you so much for listening, folks. We want to hear your stories of your favorite auto museums here in the U.S. or anywhere in the world, open or closed, and what you like about them. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on Twitter. We are Car Stuff or some derivation thereof.
And thanks for listening, everyone.
Car Stuff is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.